Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, yes, welcome to another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, which is a podcast.
It is a podcast. We are here to fill your bookshelf. If it isn't already groaning with books that we've recommended this year, last year, the year before, yeah. It will be soon.
Just when you thought you could save some money or some shelving,
nope.
We're going to spoil it. Brian, who's in Florida. Hello, Simon. Hello, Matt. There's nothing better than looking at my phone and seeing a new Books of the Year episode is available. My 30-minute commute in sunny Coconut Creek, Florida.
Wow, Coconut Creek.
I mean, sounds like he's a ride at a fair.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
You don't go to work. You go to a fancy Peter Pan land.
It is.
But maybe it's like that in Florida. Anyway, it feels like a breeze when listening to you guys. Keep up the great work, although my financial advisor would prefer it if you went off air. Whenever I listen to you guys, I buy two or three books. I recently enjoyed S.A. Cosby, Simon Sebag, Montefiore. That'll keep you going.
Yeah.
And David McCloskey, three authors I found with your podcast. Thanks for the pod. And P.S., please mention that my wife, Tanya, needs to support me in building additional bookshelves in our home. We've been together for almost 24 years and I only have one main shelf. It's time for a second, no? I am trying to apply pressure from all angles and will play the episode when she is in the car with me. So, Tanya, I think another shelf.
I mean, come on.
Another set of shelves.
Maybe three or four shelves. How have you only got one shelf for books?
Maybe it's a shelf that just goes around the entire house.
That would be true. I've seen very long shelves. That is true. An email from Helen, who, of course, can write to us, as indeed anyone can, on booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Dear literary fiction and commercial fiction, I have been listening to your fabulous pod since its inception, and you are now my go-to for which books I should read next. Indeed. While listening to your recent conversation with Araminta Hall, I just had to respond to fellow contributor Mark, who asked whether other listeners revisit the back catalogue of new authors recommended by you both and your interviewees. Well, this is me, says Helen. Just a few examples. You introduced me to John Boyne some years ago, so I then read all his other books. The Heart's Invisible Furies has become one of my favourite reads ever. I think with John Boyne, I would not have discovered him but through this podcast and what we did previously. In turn, John...
What was that? I forget.
I mean, it's all disappeared, hasn't it, into the darkness. In turn, John recommended American author Anne Tyler. So I read all her books too. There are lots, but I thoroughly recommend them, by the way. Steve Kavanagh is another author who my husband Nick and I are working our way through. Then, on Steve's recommendation, and by the way, Steve did the greatest recommendations ever. On his recommendation, I got Everyone Here Is Lying by Shari LaPena for Christmas. What a page turner. You've read that, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I bought it on his recommendation.
Yeah, he did such a great job,
right.
Steve. Yeah. The list goes on, including S.A. Cosby, Ben McIntyre. As you can see, we read a mixture of genre, but I think that is the genius of your selections because I've discovered authors I never would have read otherwise. We are avid users of our local libraries. Good for you. We're lucky to have two within a couple of miles, and our usage has definitely increased since the pandemic. Every cloud, as they say. Anyway, keep up the good work. Many thanks, Helen Duxbury.
Thank you, Helen. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email anytime, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Twitter is @booksoftheyear. Instagram and Threads @pickanypage. Right, let's talk with today's special guest, best-selling novelist and former guest on this here podcast.
Yes, indeed.
Alex Michaelides. Alex Michaelides, very nice to see you again. How are you?
I am very happy to be here, Simon. Thank you very much for having me.
You are also very jet-lagged.
I am also jet-lagged, but still happy to be here.
Where have you been?
I've been in America. I'm doing my big first US tour, and so I have been all over the place. And now I'm in England for a week.
So what is a big US... So this is presumably on the back of your previous two books, the first one of which, Secret Patient...
Silent Patient.
Secret Patient, that's...
That's a different...
That's also a very
English
good title.
No.
So, yeah.
I'll make a note of that one. I should write that one next. Silent Patient did so well for your New York Times bestseller and so on, and presumably these are the benefits and fruits of being a successful New York Times bestselling writer.
Yeah, I guess so, and also because I think they don't tour debut novelists at Celadon Macmillan, where I am at, and then the second tour got cancelled because of COVID for the second book, and so now I'm doing a big tour, and it's really quite an eye opener. Yeah,
and is that a tour of bookshops, is it a tour of radio studios? Who are the people who are talking to you?
It's mainly ticketed events in bookshops.
Okay.
And they're selling way bigger than our expectations, so it's a lot of people every night, and it's amazing to meet all these readers around the US. It feels very surreal but wonderful, yeah.
Okay. So, but you have lived in America before, haven't you? So, because you were a screenwriter.
That's right. Yeah, I lived in Los Angeles for about 4 years.
So you must know what to expect.
Well, you think you do. You know New York and you know LA, and then you realize that you know not very little of America. So it's kind of interesting seeing all the parts that kind of join up the dots, so to speak.
And now you're the star.
And that's kind of stretching it slightly. But I think people love the book. And it's kind of, it's nice being a writer. It's nice. I can't imagine what it would be like to be an actor and be recognised and all that kind of stuff. So you're kind of, you know, under the radar as a writer. But people do love the book, which is really flattering.
So the book is called The Fury. Matt, will you do the honours and describe it?
Yes, I mean, appropriately enough, given that this is a book set on mainly on a Greek island, it's a very tiny, dark Greek island on the horizon.
Looks a bit like Thunderbird Island.
It does, doesn't it? Yes,
for any
there's
fans
nothing
of
around
Thunderbirds.
It. And it's set against a Mediterranean sky at dusk, so the red sky dominating the top half of the book and the waves beneath it, and then the Fury in big white bold letters in the centre with Alex Michaelides at the bottom, and then the tagline at the top: there were seven of us on the island, one of us was a murderer, .. and something nice from Lucy Foley, the undisputed master of the twist.
Yeah, it's pretty nice of him.
I think my favourite piece of punctuation is the ellipsis.
Yeah.
Oh, I got in trouble with the first draft. My agent, I clearly sent him into a rage because he sent it back to me with all the ellipses circled and said, stop doing this and get rid of them.
Yeah, but agent is a nightmare.
Oh,
so.
Yes, of course.
Oh, right.
And he supports Manchester United. So really, you know, you just need to tell him, you know, I'm the best-selling author here. If I want to put in an ellipsis, I am going to put in an ellipsis. Thank you very much.
I shall tell him that.
Excellent. So explain the title, first of all.
The title is referring to the wind in the Greek islands, because I think they kind of misrepresent the Greek islands to you as a tourist, speaking as somebody who is from that part of the world. They don't tell you about the wind, and the wind does drive you crazy, particularly where this novel is set in the Aegean. It's relentless. And I first got the idea for the book when I was about 20 and I was on the island of Mykonos, and I got stuck there for 3 days because the wind was so tremendous you couldn't go. There were no boat could arrive or leave. Not a bad place to be stuck.
No.
Then I thought, oh, that's a great way of keeping people somewhere. And then I parked the idea for, you know, 20 odd years and then came back to it.
So the island in which we spend most of the book is a made-up island.
It is.
Was it always going to be a made-up island, or was it actually originally based on Mykonos or somewhere similar?
It's based on like a collection of islands that I've been to over the years. And it's also, I grew up in Cyprus too. And so I found that aspect of the book easiest to write. I think it's because in my first book was set in a psychiatric unit, and having worked in one, I had already done the research. Second novel, I set it at Cambridge, but it'd been a long time since I was a student. And I then had to do a massive amount of research, and I set myself ridiculous ideas of like writing a Greek tragedy lecture. So I just spent a year working before I could even write the book. And this time I thought I wanted the setting to be something I knew really well. So I thought, oh, I'll just base it on a Greek island, and I just, you know, use my imagination living in Cyprus all those years.
Okay, so introduce us to the story then, and our central character. Maybe start with the narrator.
Mm, sure. Okay, so it's about an ex-movie star who invites her six best friends to spend Easter with her on her private Greek island. And then they get trapped there because of the wind, and then there's a murder. But we can talk about this a little bit more, I think, as well. But what I wanted to do was to try and take that kind of familiar classic setup of people being on an island and then flip it on its head. So I had a lot of fun playing with the twists and turns in the novel.
So the film star is Lana, and mm-hmm. our narrator is Elliot.
That's correct, yes.
Who guides us through mm-hmm. The entire... I just want to read something from page 199. This isn't going to give anything away. Just to give people an example of the kind of thing that Elliot is saying, mm-hmm. okay? And if this is unfair, then... Actually, why don't you read it? Because it's your book. Just the first three paragraphs.
Sure.
Now, Alex Michaelides reads from his own book. Here we go.
Perhaps this is a good place to pause and take stock before we proceed. I am aware of the conventions of this genre. I know what's meant to happen next. I know what you're expecting. A murder investigation, a denouement, a twist. That's how it's supposed to play out. But as I warned you at the start, that's not the way this is going to go.
Okay. So what are we hearing there? We're hearing someone who's playful mm-hmm. And is trying to tell a story, but is meandering and so. Who is Elliot, and what kind of a narrator is he?
He is an unreliable narrator, a self-proclaimed one.
Yes.
he's the most fun part in the book for me. I wrote the story in the third person, first of all. And then when I finished the first draft, it just felt lifeless and dead. And I thought, okay, this isn't working. Either I can bin this or I can try and radically rethink it. And I was walking outside and I'm reciting the opening lines of the book to myself, as you do. And I asked myself for the first time, who is talking? And then I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if it's this minor character, Elliot, and he's telling us the story? And until then, his purpose had been just to kind of make wisecracks and drink martinis in the background. And then I thought, oh, it'd be fun because he's a playwright who's very aware of this genre, if he was telling us this story. And then the model for him, I suppose, was a bit like George Saunders in All About Eve, or the narrator in Laura. I love, you know, this kind of 1950s movies. And I thought it would be fun to have this kind of sophisticated, wry, you know, semi-sarcastic narrator. Part of it also came from my best friend is a critic, and he read my first two books, and he said, you know, they're quite serious books. And he said, in real life, you can occasionally be funny. It might be a good idea to try and get a sense of humour into your novels. And that really stayed with me, particularly having written such a depressing, miserable second book. I thought, I really am going to kill myself unless I have some fun with the third one or stop writing. I was feeling quite negative about the whole thing. And so to finally have a sense, you know, a narrator with a sense of humour was a joy for me. Yeah,
I think you've definitely had fun with this, Alex. I want to dig a little deeper into Elliot because I suppose the question I'm going to be asking is, how do you feel about Elliot? You've already said you think he's a lot of fun. There's a section of the book. I always feel that authors deliberately put in a little clue to us as we're reading as to how we're meant to feel about narrators or the main character in a book. And my little clue that I found was when Elliot starts talking about martinis and cocktails. And I was like, oh, my God, cocktail bores. I cannot abide cocktails. You should have your own place, your own bars. If you're going to order anything more complicated than a gin and tonic, get out of my pub. I don't want to be stood behind you. I don't want to be serving you.
Matt's so, quite judgmental.
Yeah, oh, we must never have a drink together, ever.
Oh, right. But that was a point where I thought, oh, right, Alex is... This is a little clue from Alex that I should not be wholly sympathetic towards Elliot. I'm now picking up that actually that's something that I was wrong on that.
You're making me laugh because I'm a recovering cocktail bore.
Oh,
and
right.
I have, you know, sent martinis back in my time until a good friend of mine said to me, you know, Alex, it might just be easier for everybody if you ordered vodka on the rocks.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, that's a fair point. So I've learned from that. So I completely take your point.
But just to the wider point, which is, or the wider question, how do you feel about Elliot? You say he's a bit of fun. How would how would you like us to feel? But more importantly, how do you feel about him?
I don't know. It's an odd question. It's a really good question. It's really... I don't know how other writers feel, but I find it... I think I have a different relationship to my characters than other people do because I don't tend to judge them at all. And so my feelings get hurt when people say that Theo from my first book is a sociopath or stuff like that. I don't, or Elliot is divisive. I do find that some people really, really dislike him. I don't think of them like that. I think of them a bit like my best friends, I suppose. And you can't really judge your best friends, or you wouldn't have any best friends. Well, I wouldn't. And so I kind of just accept them at face value, try to get into their minds and hearts and sort of think about what happened to them as children. That's a huge part of it for me. So I wrote pages and pages about their childhoods, which none of which made it into the novel, because I thought it was important that I knew that, but not necessarily that the reader knew that. I just need to know where they're coming from. And then it feels easy for me just to have empathy for them.
Because you do have, you talk, there are sections about Elliot's childhood that do make it into this book, and that is a key part of where our sympathies sort of get attached more to, or more strongly to Elliot then.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a big part of writing the book for me, was thinking about his childhood. I've been carrying around that kind of stuff in my head for a long time, and all the therapy stuff, and, you know, he has the same experience that I did in therapy, where I had a lot of therapy because I was pretty messed up when I was younger. And one day my therapist suggested to me that, you know, all of us are carrying around a frightened, wounded child in our heads. And unless we're aware of that, the child can very often run the show. And that was a light bulb moment for me. And I thought it would be really interesting to try and weave that thinking throughout the novel as well.
Does that small child make an appearance every now and again, or, you know, and is that a healthy thing if the small child makes an appearance, or is it you just have to be able to spot when the small child is there and tell him to get back in his box?
It's not necessarily getting back in his box. I think it's more about just being aware of when we can often confuse the past and the present, and if we're feeling irrationally angry or irrationally afraid, that's usually a red flag that more is going on here than is just immediately apparent. You might be confusing, you know. Like, I remember one moment years and years ago when I was just in the supermarket, and this guy behind me in the checkout queue was giving me kind of shifty looks, and I felt really quite afraid of him. And then I suddenly thought, oh, wait a second, he's not my dad, and I'm not 8 years old. And the moment I had that thought, everything was put back in perspective, and I was like, oh, I can also defend myself. This is a completely fine situation. But I think sometimes we act from the place of a frightened child, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you said you wrote it in the third person to start with, and now it's written in the first person, and Elliot is our guide. But there are still references to what other people are thinking.
Yes.
So we still see inside other people's heads. So how does that work if it's a first person narration, that we kind of also know what other people are thinking?
He is imagining. He says early on that I am guessing what people are thinking,
right,
but of course I could be wrong. You know, I think a major inspiration for the novel was The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, which is one of my favourite novels. And I first encountered that when I was about 17. And I would say that he's one of the first unreliable narrators in fiction in that book, where he tells us about his relationship with his four friends. And then about halfway through the book, we realise that he's lying. And there's flashbacks within flashbacks, and you don't quite know what version of reality you're getting from him. And I always thought that was kind of fascinating. Also, Simon, the reason it kind of possibly meanders in terms of point of view in this is that I changed the way that I wrote for this novel. I didn't plan it like I planned my first two books. I plotted them for like a year and a half before writing a single word. And
Wow.
It takes the joy out totally. You know, I think you're doing it because it's like a control thing. And also you want to make sure it all works, the twist, if you're building towards something. And this time I thought I wanted to have real fun, so I decided just to come up with the characters and the location, not know the identity of the murderer or the victim.
And because Lee Child often said, well, he always used to say that's how he approaches his story. He just gets Jack Reacher walking somewhere and sees what happens. And Ian Rankin does the same when he starts with a particular scene and he doesn't. And I find it almost impossible to comprehend how you can start and not know who the murderer is. But that was exactly the way you started this.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it doesn't involve it's an exercise in having faith. And I was worried that nothing would materialise at the end, but it did. So I felt really happy about that. Having said that, it does involve a lot of rewriting. You know, and that was when I was a student at the American Film Institute in Los Angeles. We were always taught by the writer, the teachers, to outline, not write drafts, because it saves time. And so you can write a million outlines, but you know, a million drafts takes many, many years. Yeah. And so that was part of where I was coming from. But I think in the future, I'm going to combine both approaches because I did get a real sense of, I fell in love with writing again. And even the sad bits in this book, I was writing with a smile on my face. And what's fun, like there were certain elements, like Elliot has a relationship with a kind of toxic older writer called Barbara West. And she just appeared, like fully formed, name, everything, backstory, everything, just as he was telling me this story. And I've never had a character...
As he was telling you the story?
Yeah, it sounds...
It's your character that's telling you the story.
Yeah, I think he's in a bar talking to somebody, and I think I'm the person that he's talking to. And I know it sounds wildly pretentious, but it's the first time I ever experienced... because I let go of the reins, a character kind of come alive for me in that way. And it was really fun.
I don't think that sounds pretentious at all. I think there are a number of writers who will have that same feeling about how they're writing, then suddenly things that they hadn't thought of before are just revealed to them. Did you have more fun doing it that way rather than planning it? Or if, let's say, for your fourth book, which method would you choose then? Would you choose the planning or would you choose the sitting down and let's see what happens, even if it involves tons and tons of rewrites?
I think it depends on what kind of book you're writing. I think, you know, that's why the Lee Child analogy is interesting and makes more sense. I think Ian Rankin, wow, that's brave. Because I think of this as a thriller, even though it's possibly more of just a character study. But I think if you're writing a complicated detective story and you don't know where it's going, I don't know how you would do that. I think you do need to have kind of a lot of planning. And I think for the next book, which is more of a detective story, I have it planned, but I'm going to allow myself to deviate from the plan this time.
I'm going to be really careful how I ask this question, because we're really keen for people to read the book and I don't want to give anything away. So you've already read that sort of section from that Simon sort of highlighted of I know what you're expecting. You're expecting twists. Well, this isn't a story like that, but nothing is as it seems. Let's say that. OK. And the impression I got from the book was that that Elliot was the other characters appeared to be performing in a theatre production that Elliot had written, and they had no idea that in other words that it was a drama that Elliot was putting together that they had no idea they were actually that they were in this theatre production. That was the impression I was left with. Would that be something that you would tally with, or is that completely out of the blue?
Yeah, totally. I think it was very much, it's about theatre, it's about acting. And to some degree, everybody is acting in the novel and he's trying to orchestrate it all. Whether he succeeds or not is a different question. But yeah, no, it's very much about that. And it kind of, you know, it was sort of, you know, thematic in a way too, because the characters are, you know, it's a world I know really well. It's about a movie star and a British theatre actress and a playwright. And so it felt natural to me that also the structure of the book, you know, it's told in five acts. It's very much a theatrical piece.
I didn't know that was your background. So clearly comes across in the book that you know your stuff. I didn't know that beforehand. Mm-hmm. So what is your background?
Well, I studied screenwriting and I wrote three disastrous films that went from bad to worse. And it kind of drove me into writing a novel. But I just, you know, Tom Stoppard always says that what you love, you're not necessarily very good at. And I love movies and I wanted to be part of movies, but I don't think I was very talented as a screenwriter. But I was around a lot of famous people and kept my eyes and ears open and saw some really ghastly behaviour and thought, oh, one day I must write about this. And then I had the idea of trapping them on a Greek island and throwing in a murder.
So in a way, this book is like the perfect combination of things that you know lots about. So the Greek island and the Greek mythology, badly behaving Hollywood stars and therapy.
Yes, it's true. And I do think it's sort of you shuffle the same deck of cards, perhaps, or, you know, or was it Hitchcock who said, you know, every director just remakes the same film again and again and again. I do think there's certain preoccupations that I'm always going to return to. But the way I think about writing is never just one idea. I always think about it as a collision of ideas. So like with The Silent Patient, it was this Greek myth of the Alcestis I'd been puzzling over for decades and then working in a psychiatric unit and then a love of Agatha Christie. And then one day they just went kind of bang in my mind and then I came up with the story. And so that's how I tend to work now. I tend to think about different themes and then throw them together.
A lot of people might have thought Agatha Christie's, when Matt was describing what's on the cover, there were seven of us on an island, one of us was a murderer. It's like classic, an absolutely classic setup. And in the acknowledgements at the end, you mentioned Agatha Christie, Anthony Schaffer, Patricia Highsmith, and Ford Madox Ford, who you've just mentioned. The Agatha Christie bit, I think everyone will get, even if they haven't read the book. They'll just from those two lines, go, oh, okay, yes, I sort of know where we are, though from the way you've talked about it, maybe I don't. Maybe I shouldn't feel too settled. Anthony Schaffer and Patricia Highsmith, what is their input here?
Patricia Highsmith, because I feel like you can't. There's definite shades of Tom Ripley. And it was interesting seeing Saltburn, because I thought, oh, how funny. It is kind of almost, it's in the same universe as my novel. Definitely thinking about Tom Ripley always when she's created this kind of anti-hero that we all are obsessed with in Tom Ripley. And it's definitely influenced me as I've been growing up. Also just the glamour of it, I think, Talented Mr. Ripley is one of my favorite movies. And I think about Minghella a lot, and I was trying to recreate, live in that world a little bit. And Schaffer, because of the twists, Sleuth is one of my favourite movies, the original, with Olivier and Michael Caine. And I've seen it so many times, and it's just so clever. And so I kind of tend to, the way I think I write as a fan, if that makes sense. And so I tend to obsessively reread, rewatch things, absorb them, digest them, marry them with my own interests, and then spew something else out off at the end of it.
In what way is Saltburn in the same universe as this?
It's about...
this is the Emerald Fennell movie, which is being nominated for... some people love it, some people do not like it.
Yes, I'm aware.
Quite so much.
Just that sort of, in the way that it's like Talented Mr. Ripley, it's about a young man who's trying to fit in with people who have a lot more money and a lot more sophistication than him, and trying to, endear himself to them.
So is there something of, so Elliot Chase, your narrator, is there something of him in Barry Keoghan's character?
Yes.
Who's the central character in Saltburn?
I think so, definitely. And I think... I think Elliot, the more we get to know Elliot, the more we realise that he's not quite as sophisticated as he pretends to be, and that he's coming from quite a dark, messed up place. Yeah.
We're going to talk in the separate podcast about your likes and dislikes as far as other books are concerned, but I do want to dig into the sort of the twisty side of things, because I was a huge fan of Silent Patient, and this
surely Secret Patients,
surely not.
That would be the sequel.
And also the idea with this book that, as I say, nothing is as it seems. And I wondered whether that is a sort of genre of literature that you're drawn to. Are the kind of books that you enjoy reading ones where we're not quite sure where there's twists aplenty?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me it comes back to Christie. I don't think anybody did it better than she did. And I think when you read a novel that's set on a small island where people die, she's hovering over your shoulder the whole time. And I thought, what could I bring that's not just a pale copy of her book? And I thought, well, I can bring the reader's expectations because of her, and the countless copies of, and then there were none. When we read a book like this or pick up a book like this, we think we know what we're getting into. And then I thought, okay, well, so what's fun is then to have play with the reader's expectations, and then to have a narrator who's very aware of their expectations. And so the whole thing becomes about a dialogue between the reader and the narrator, which was a lot of fun to write. Yeah.
So when you're having your conversations with your narrator, were there any points that you disagreed with him? I know this sounds like a very surreal conversation, but when the magic happens, when you're thinking, wow, where did that come from? You mentioned Barbara West, she emerged with her backstory fully formed. Did Elliot ever take you down paths that you thought, no, I don't think so, or I think I need to wrestle him back to the story that I want to tell?
That's interesting. There was stuff that I cut, absolutely, yeah. I think he could have... He went on quite a journey telling us about his childhood and then leaving home as a boy. And there were whole sections of him being at school that eventually I cut. There's a point when I have this kind of terror of being boring. I think it's inherent in the genre that you write. And he quotes Tennessee Williams at one point. He quotes. It was this... I love it. It's a Tennessee Williams advice to aspiring dramatists, which is, don't be boring, baby. Do whatever it takes to keep the thing going. Blow up a bomb on stage if you have to, but don't be boring. And so whenever I felt that Elliot was getting boring, as in interesting to me, but not telling the story, I'd cut it. And again, that comes back from screenwriting. Billy Wilder always said that any scene without a plot point in it is a bad scene, and cut it in the script form because you will shoot it and not use it. And I've always remembered that advice. And so it's one of my cardinal rules is that every chapter has to have a brick, a story brick in it, a story beat. Otherwise, I won't let myself be in it, use it. And so I had to cut things unwillingly. But
just because it was interesting, but it actually didn't develop the story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Do screenwriters, you in particular, but maybe screenwriters in general, just inherently write cinematically? With kind of, even if it's subliminal, even if it's just deep somewhere, that you write in a way that someone who is going to direct a movie would go, I like that.
I think, possibly. I think I didn't become better at screenwriting until I quit screenwriting. Because I think my formative experience of writing anything, really, was the last film that I made, which I wrote... And Uma Thurman was in, and we were on
set. She gets a credit in the... Yeah. An acknowledgement.
Yes, I dedicate the book to her, actually, yeah. I wrote it for her because, essentially, I wrote this... I was writing A Silent Patient when we worked together, and she gave me all kinds of writing advice for The Silent Patient, all of which I used. But more importantly, she taught me how to write visually in a way that film school never had, and I... she went through the script that we had written for her and showed me why it wouldn't work, which was kind of worrying as we were on set. And then she said some things that I've never forgotten. Like she said to me, Alex, every scene has to be an attempt, at least an attempt at an iconic image. And if you're not trying, then you're just failing. And so it can't just be, in her opinion, in my opinion, two people just sitting and chatting endlessly. There has to be something visual there. And so, for example, there was a scene when she was the heroine and she was being held up at gunpoint by the baddie. And I'd written that with her sitting in a chair. And Uma thought it would be vastly improved by the incorporation of Japanese rope bondage. And so I came home. I came to the set.
I mean, most things were improved. Japanese rope bondage.
And I came to the set after lunch and I found Uma dangling from the ceiling, wrapped in ropes. And it was that kind
no
of...
No one's ever said that before.
It was an education. And I learned a lot. And I thought, well, one day I must write something for her. And then all these years later, I wrote the part of Lana for her. And so, if you know, it's been optioned.
So this has been optioned.
Mm, yeah.
So and you've thought of Uma as Luna Farah.
As Lana Farah.
Lana Farah, yeah. I can't read my own writing.
Luna is actually the name of her daughter.
There you go. That's obviously what I was thinking. Yeah. And would you inherently think... instinctively think, I'm writing that screenplay?
Well, Simon, funnily enough, I am writing that screenplay. Yeah.
You have started.
I have started. I've done a couple of drafts. I thought there were two things going on in my mind. One was I thought I would be sick of these characters and this world. But I think I chose well this time because I like these characters and I'm having fun reimagining them in a new situation, writing new stuff. So that's great. And I thought I wanted to have a go now. I feel like I've learned so much from writing novels, from the interiority of novel writing and from just practicing. I feel I'm much better writer than I was 10 years ago when I wrote The Silent Patient. And so I feel ready to have another bash at screenwriting. And I've been really scared of the initial drafts, but I've enjoying myself very much. So who knows? I'm sure they will replace me imminently, but I'm enjoying it myself.
I think it's perfectly good form to quote another podcast. And I imagine you listen to the Script Notes podcast, which is...
Yeah, I do constantly. Yeah.
Which is a podcast for screenwriters about things that are interesting to screenwriters. And they were talking about the screenplay for Oppenheimer and how they'd never seen a screenplay written in the first person.
I thought it was fascinating, yeah.
And I thought it was fascinating. Well, here are people who this is their world, this is everything that they do, but until Christopher Nolan wrote the screenplay for Oppenheimer, no one had done one in a first person before. What did you, having just done a book which is in the first person, as we've discussed, what did you think, oh... maybe I could do that, maybe with this or with another project.
Yeah. Um, I I thought it was also, yes, it was completely fascinating. Weirdly enough, the producer, Nina Jacobson, is an amazing producer, and she's suggested that we increase, I don't want to talk about it too much, but the add more voiceover from different characters. And so it's even more first person than there is in the novel. So I'm going into other people's heads. I think it's really interesting. It's a way, I think why it works so well in Oppenheimer is because it allows you access to his mind all the time. And I think that's a difficulty in adapting a very confessional novel, is that some of that gets lost. And in the fury I'm talking about. But by really focusing on that, yeah, it's kind of still has the psychological insight. I think it's brilliant, interesting. Yeah.
So you're working on the screenplay for The Fury. You've also said your next book is going to be a combination of the way you've approached the first two and the way you've done the third. Is there anything else you could tell us about book four?
I'm looking into my childhood. I think I'm going to write about my parents. I grew up in a house where my mother is English and my father is Greek Cypriot. And there was a lot of culture clashes, mainly about food. I thought it would be fun to explore that world a bit. So yeah,
I'm probably. And is it fun or is it problematic?
It's funny. Whether it's fun or not, I don't know. We'll see. It's kind of sometimes you go to quite dark places as a thriller writer, and you think, well, people must think I'm absolutely insane, but I probably am quite insane. So,
Alex, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you very much indeed. Alex Michaelides' book is The Fury. And there'll be more with Alex in our companion podcast when we do the Q&A very shortly. But congratulations on this and all of your success, all of which I think boils down to our original interview with you. For The Secret Patient, which is still the book that I read, even if it's not the book you wrote. More with Alex in a couple of days. But for the moment, Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.